Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a question we get frequently. I have some grapevines in my backyard. Everything looks so perfect in the spring. But then by the time we get to harvest time, everything's all tangled up and rotten. What do I need to spray on them? Quite possibly the answer is nothing, but there are some things you need to do to prevent disease in most fruits. We'll tell you what they are when we get to the question of the week, but mostly it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heaping helping of your fascinating phone call comments, questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. at 1-888-346-9499. Lynn, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, I'm Lynn, and I live in Edmond, Oklahoma. And I've had a recurrent question over the last, since February, about what to do with roses. And then I heard a question, somebody called in a couple weeks ago. I thought I had a partial answer, but I still would like to understand the whole thing. So, first of all, when to prune roses, and I think I heard you say that it is after, say, 2 weeks of some kind of blooming or leafing out, then you can prune.
That is almost exactly correct. A lot of people injure their roses, especially in climates with cold winters, by pruning them back in the fall because, you know, they want to clean up the garden. They want it to look better. But pruning will stimulate growth at any time of year other than the deep winter. So what they do is they force the poor rose to start growing, and it weakens the whole root system and crown. And then if they get a miserable winter, they've got a half-dead rose out there already. So, yeah, the smart money says just leave it alone, watch a lot of wintertime TV, and then wait for new growth to appear. Check off 2 weeks on the calendar, and then go out, and you really can't hurt them if that's when you prune.
Well, what happened this year was they started leafing out, and you know Oklahoma has very erratic weather. So,
oh, you think
it was nice?
Are you sure? Are you sure, Lynn? Maybe something like howling 150-mile-an-hour winds every day, dust storms, 110 degrees.
Right, and then in the middle of a very cold winter, we could have 80-degree weather with no wind, and it just is wonderful, and everything starts sprouting. And then all of a sudden we're back into freezing weather with the wind. And that's what happened. And so I probably jumped the gun and started pruning. And then it got real cold again.
Right.
And then a lot of stuff died. I mean, the stalks were dying.
How early in the season did you prune, Lynn?
I want to say, well, it probably wasn't the end of February, but it was in March.
That's pretty early. That's pretty early. I like to think about like Mother's Day, something like that.
Ah, okay. But by Mother's Day, I usually have roses.
Yeah, well, you are in a much hotter climate than I am. But February, yeah, you know you still got some hard frost to come.
Right. So what happened is then I had all these stalks. Mm-hmm. And very unattractive, two climbing roses and one tea rose. And then I'm thinking, well, what should I do now? Should I cut off these dead-looking things because they just look terrible?
Mm-hmm.
But I said, well, I'll wait to see if anything, you know, comes out of it. At the bottom, they started to sprout, and they've sort of regrown from the bottom.
Yep.
And then I was wondering, should I cut these long stalks that just look like they're dead?
The answer
is
yes.
Or should I just wait? I should. Okay.
The answer is yes. What happened is that instead of pruning them, stimulating growth, and then having to survive an entire winter, you pruned them a little early. The new growth froze, but it was in the beginning of the season when they still had all their stored energy underground. So people who prune their roses right before winter and stimulate new growth, that poor rose loses so much of its vitality. You pruned it a little early in the spring, stimulated new growth, that new growth froze, but the rose underground still had all of its life force intact. So anytime something like this happens, you wait until you make sure you're out of the frost zone, that it's not going to do another freeze on you, and then you cut off the dead parts. And you're always going to get that regrowth down low. And I don't know if you do it or not, but as soon as an old rose is done outside, you should prune it off to stimulate new growth. Because even on these roses that are said to be only bloom once a season, I find if you're really good about deadheading the faded flowers, they often continue to produce.
Thanks so much, Mike.
All right.
It really was, so I may, these roses may be better than ever. They're looking actually, beginning to look better than they did before.
Yes, and once we get into this part of the season, up until we get to like August or September, always cut off any bad branches.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good luck, Lynn. Take
Bye-bye.
Care. 1-888-346-9499. Bruce, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Bruce. How are you?
Great.
And where is Bruce great?
Just southeast of Raleigh, North Carolina. But I grew up in Germantown.
In Germantown? In the Germantown?
Germantown, Philadelphia.
Excellent.
My son's living in Philadelphia now. He moved back up there months ago.
Philadelphia has been experiencing a huge renaissance of young people moving back into the city for many years now. It's very exciting. It's a great place to be.
Oh, yeah.
So what can we do for Bruce in the Carolinas?
What do you do about moles? I don't have them, but my neighbor does, and his yard is just riddled with tunnels.
Raised tunnels, right?
Right.
Yeah.
They're definitely moles because my cat caught one of them.
You know, you must have a very good ratting cat, you know, because moles don't come above ground.
I don't know how Petey got it, but he brought it home and left it on the porch.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I heard a guy on Terry Gross's show on Fresh Air, a guy who had written a book called Cat Sense, that when your cat catches something and calls out to you and shows it off, oh, look what a good predator I am. Look how I'm protecting you. This guy says it was more possible that the cat wants you to turn the key and get the toy working again because it's not as much fun anymore now.
I never thought of that.
Moles are really difficult, Bruce. The first thing your friend should do is this fall, as we get to around August, he should apply milky spore disease to his lawn. This is a naturally occurring soil bacterium. So any Japanese beetles, June beetles, rose chafer beetles, any kind of the variations of scarab beetles that you have down in the Carolinas, all of their larvae will be these ugly white grubs in the soil, often in lawns.
Okay.
Milky spore disease is the naturally occurring soil organism found in Japan that is the reason Japanese beetles aren't a problem in Japan. There's a lot of this natural, quote, disease in the soil that limits their numbers. If a beetle grub ingests a milky disease spore, it dies, and then its body becomes a factory for more milky spore. So if you have grubs in your soil and you apply milky spore in the fall, it does not work in the spring. It only works in the fall. And you get the timing right and you have some grubs, so that eliminates forever pretty much that one big food source. Because moles only eat three things. They're carnivorous: earthworms, beetle grubs, and cicada larvae.
Well, we have a lot of cicadas down here, too.
Anytime you have a big cicada season, you're going to have a big mole season. Because the moles love to eat cicada larvae underground. And I don't know of anything you can put in the soil that kills cicadas. Milky spore is very specific. It only affects the larval stage of scarab beetles. It doesn't harm other soil life or earthworms or cicada larvae.
Okay.
So that's step one. Step two is to go out and get a castor oil-based repellent. These are professionally made and packaged. They're sold in liquid and powdered form. And what you want, or your friend wants, is to get the highest concentration of castor oil as an active ingredient. And there are poisons that you can buy, too, but they are worthless because the moles won't eat poison. It just poisons other creatures in the environment. You want to make sure it's castor oil, and he should put down a heavy concentration of it in the fall and again in the spring. And then the only thing left after that is traps. The old school ones are spring loaded, and man, a lot of people wind up hiring professionals to install and inspect them because they'll take your finger off if you screw up. And they're very hard to set correctly. At least that's always been the word on them.
All right. Great.
And that's the sequence. You get rid of your lawn grubs naturally. You keep that castor oil smell in the soil. And then some traps. And hopefully that'll take care of business.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, Bruce. And just let them know. It takes a while. It's a long process.
Great. I will. I'll tell them.
All right. Good luck, man.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll deliver my best mid-season garden advice at noon and 2 p.m. on Sunday, June 26th at a fabulous family event, the Burlington County Earth Fair at historic Smithville Park in Mount Holly, New Jersey. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with great grapes and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, backyard grapes can be very rewarding, but they are not a plant it and leave it alone kind of crop. You have to prune them heavily in the winter, you have to give them good support, and then you have to do something during the growing season that all the people that write me with problems don't do. Don't be one of them. Stay tuned to the end of the show, and we'll tell you how to have great-looking grapes. Otherwise, it's your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Logan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, what's going on? How you doing?
I am doing very well, Logan. How are you, sir?
I'm okay. Just hanging out at work. I had a quick question for you, though. I was in Churchill Downs in Kentucky for the Kentucky Derby.
Right.
And my question for you is, what would be involved in maybe converting all that wonderful, luscious landscape to be organic?
Oh, you mean the fields where the horses pasture or the grounds itself? What?
Well, you know, I mean, like, they've got just, like, these amazing flower beds and gardens and everything like that, you know?
Well,
households with this crazy colors, and you know, could you still get that if it was organic?
The answer is yes, 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 and yes. And the shining example is someplace that I think really probably a majority of Americans have probably visited but didn't know they were surrounded by an organic landscape or organically managed hotel rooms because nobody tells them. There's no signage. It's just their way of doing business. Are you ready? Down in Epcot at Disney World.
Really?
Back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, I was invited to go down and be the keynote speaker at the Earth Day event that Epcot holds every year during their annual Flower and Garden Festival. They put on a large-scale outdoor flower show every year, very specifically in Epcot. And while I was down there, Katie Moss Warner, a woman who ran the horticulture program, who later went to become president of the American Horticultural Society, told me that they had simply decided one day they hated working with these chemicals. They went home guilty that the workers were spraying these things around. So they came in and announced that they were going to change everything over to organic. Everything in the park was going to be composted. They took a huge corner and set up this giant composting facility. So, you know, all of the greenery from the greenhouse, all of the food waste, everything in that section of the park got composted. And what was funny was the workers did not buy into it. She would still find them going out and spraying Roundup and using the chemical fertilizers and stuff. And so one day she called her senior staff, and they made a midnight raid on their own facility and drove in unannounced with a rental truck, took all the chemicals out and hid them. And the next day when the workers showed up, they went, well, you're going to have to figure out how to do it our way now. And it is astounding, especially considering the fact they're in southern Florida, where as you get further down the coast, the increasing temperatures and humidity increase the number of pests and greatly increase the disease pressures. But they do simple things like watering only at the right time of day in the morning, using massive amounts of compost to replace the organic matter that burns up so much in the heat down there. And when I asked, how come you're not publicizing this, screaming it from like the rooftops, there was a perception that people would think it wasn't as clean or as nice if it were done organically. So there was still that misconception that, you know, organic meant holes in the produce or mice in the rooms. And instead, it was absolutely one of the most beautiful horticultural places I've ever seen. But in terms of actually taking a place like Churchill Downs or Disney World or anywhere like that and converting from chemical to organic, it is simply the act of will. It is not only easy to do, it's preferable. Just think of how big OSHA smiles when they realize nobody's spraying any chemicals. There's, you know, like a huge liability thing you don't have to worry about. And the proof is in the pudding. All it takes is the will and the knowledge. And the dirty little secret is that it's much easier than anyone ever expects. And once you get into a cycle of building up the organic matter, treating the plants with respect, after a year or so, everybody winds up slapping themselves on the forehead going, what took us so long?
Of course. All right. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate the motivation. And maybe if they hear this, they can maybe switch over.
It's people like you who get the ball rolling, Lug.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Thank you for a great question.
All right.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Shira, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Shira. How are you?
I'm good today. How are you?
I am just ducky. Thank you. Where is Shira good?
I'm calling from Fountainville, Pennsylvania.
And where's Fountainville?
It's near Doylestown.
Oh, okay, okay. Just one of the suburbs outside Philadelphia.
Yes.
All right. What can we do for Shira?
I have a composter. I've been composting for about 10 years. And a couple of years ago, I had my husband, for an anniversary present, make me a compost sifter. And I've been using it. But my composter is full of worms, and they're wonderful, but the sifter doesn't sift them out. So what's happening is that I've been using my wormy compost in my garden, and the birds have decided to make it their place to hang out, and they've been digging up my garden. So I'm not sure what to do either about the worms or how to make my compost better.
Oh, okay. Now, a compost sifter, for listeners who don't understand what we're talking about, is hardware cloth or screening, heavy-duty hardware cloth or screening, stapled to a wooden frame, and you roll your compost over top of it, and what comes out the bottom is a nice small particle size, like you get in the highly prized packaged compost. You get rid of all the chunks and stuff, and any material that isn't composted stays on top, and you throw it back in. So what kind of a composter do you have?
It looks like a big ball. It looks like a big blue ball, and it's a tumbler then.
Is it sealed?
Yes.
And there's no ground contact?
No, it's got like a bowl that sits underneath it, and it's on a track. And so you just turn the bowl.
How did the worms get inside?
I think when I first started the compost that I had taken some soil from outside and put it in there, and that's the only way I can figure. But they are real happy in there, and the kids in the area call me the worm lady because they want to come over and see them all the time.
Now, are we talking earthworms or redworms?
No, earthworms.
Earthworms. Well, you know, first of all, earthworms are not supposed to be able to live in that kind of an environment, but apparently yours are happy as worms in compost. Now, what do you compost? What materials go inside?
In the fall, I use dry leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And then throughout the spring and summer, I put in our kitchen vegetable scraps and sometimes add some extra leaves if it needs it.
Right. And do you shred the leaves?
Yes.
Okay, good, good. Well, that sounds fine. And you get good compost out of it, right?
Yeah, it's beautiful. It looks great. It's just that, like I said, these worms are, they're taking over.
That it is so unusual. Earthworms are only supposed to be able to reproduce and be really happy if they have the ability to move up and down, like in a 6-foot layer of soil, you know, to get moist or hot or cold or whatever. This is an unusual situation.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'll tell you is they're always going to be attracted to moisture. So, they don't go through the sifter, do they?
Yes, they fall right through the sifter. That's the problem. They're not big, long worms. They're about the biggest one's maybe 2 inches long.
Oh, okay. They're not earthworms.
Oh, they're not earthworms. Then what are they?
Well, you could have a million things in there, honey. And you're sure they're not maggots. You would know the difference.
Yeah.
Okay. It sounds like what you have are red worms, composting worms. But they would have had to be introduced somehow, unless you had a worm bin and you emptied it out in your garden and they survived and it got back in there. Now, I will tell you that I have the same issue. I have an indoor worm bin. And when mm-hmm. a tray is finished, I take it out and dump it in the garden. And I've stopped trying to rescue the worms because there's so many that are in the rest of the worm bin. And I don't mm-hmm. have the problem with the birds coming around. So I'm going to suggest two different things. One is that even though it's inconvenient, you do this in the middle of a rain, because then the worms will vanish underground. The birds won't even know they were there. Or that when you do put the material down for the first time, you simply get some bird netting, throw it over top of the plants for the first hour, and after that, the worms are in the soil. I mean, if you have good soil filled with earthworms and redworms, birds are always going to be taking the occasional free lunch. But if you wet the soil first, make sure the soil is nice and soaking wet, when you put your compost on and then cover it with netting for just like half an hour, the worms will follow the moisture down into the soil. You won't be able to see them. Take off the netting and you can finish spreading the compost.
Okay. That sounds great.
Yeah, you got a free worm bin somehow. I'm scratching my head, Shira, but good for you.
I'll have to send you a picture one of these days.
Yes, and also go online and look at red worms, red wigglers, yeah, or compost worms. Because it sounds for sure like you have the worms that you use to work an indoor worm bin with. So, mm-hmm, and they're incredibly valuable. They make better compost than compost.
Okay.
All right. Well, a great story.
Maybe I've hit the jackpot.
I think you have. All right. Well,
all right.
Thank you, Shira.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate your help.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Dee, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello, Dee. How are you?
I'm good.
And where is Dee good?
Well, Dee is in a very, very small town. They call it Land of the Endless Mountains. It's northwest Pennsylvania, almost near the New York state line.
And Dee, what is the name of your little town?
Emporium.
Are you up anywhere near Erie, Pennsylvania?
We're not quite that far west.
Okay. So you really are in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, what's going on for you in Emporium? What can we do for you?
Now, just recently, I got stung by a yellow jacket.
Ooh, yeah.
And we have a house where, you know, there was a little sidewalk and a little porch, concrete. And then they built a bigger porch on top of that.
Right.
A deck, sort of like that. And put lattice all around it. Well, the bees are somewhere under that porch.
Ah, so you don't even have access to the entrance hole to the nest.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Now, here's what's going on. It just starts with one queen, and she has enough eggs tucked inside her that she saved over the winter to, you know, get a couple of workers. Then, you know, the couple of workers start building a bigger nest. Then she has more. And by the time we get to late August, that nest will typically have thousands of yellow jackets in it. But, and of course, you don't have access to the hole, because what we tell people to do is cover the hole and smother the nest, which will not be reused next year. But here's what I'm going to suggest you do in your situation. Do you know these backyard insect traps, these like mosquito traps, the zappers that people put out by their pools and stuff?
Yeah, the electrical thing.
Correct. They actually don't work on mosquitoes. Mosquitoes are not attracted to them. They mostly kill beneficial insects. But they give off a hum and they give off a light. And yellow jackets are so aggressive that if you can run an extension cord out to this area and put one of those bug zappers right next to where they're coming out of the lattice work, they will fly into it and electrocute themselves. They will electrocute the entire nest, one yellow jacket at a time.
Really?
Yeah. You know, make sure you set this up on a cool night when they're not active, and then just leave it on. You know, if it rains or something, unplug it, plug it into a grounded outlet so it's safe. But yeah, they'll throw themselves at it one after the other.
Oh, wow.
And be careful, because yellow jackets can sting repeatedly. They like to sting, and they're dangerous to have around the house. You can also take quart-sized jars, like you would get fruit juice in or something like that. Empty them out. Take the lid off. Using a Phillips head screwdriver, you bang one hole in the lid. And then you put something in the jar. At some times of the year, the yellow jackets are meat eaters. So this is a couple little pieces of ham or some cat food. You put that in the jar. You put the lid back on with a hole in it. And then you just drop that jar down near where they're coming out. You can also try putting a rotten peach into another jar the same way. One filled with sweet bait, just a little bit in the bottom, and one filled with a meat bait. The yellow jackets will go in, but they can't get out. And you can really empty out a nest if you keep making traps and filling them. You know, obviously, when they are filled with yellow jackets, you just leave them alone. You let the yellow jackets cook in the sun. You don't try to empty them out or anything while they're still moving around.
The situation with us, on top of everything else, is, you know, we're having some floor work done, so we only have one, and that is the entrance.
Oh, you got it? No, no, I don't know. You got to find another way into the house. That's going to be a dangerous area.
Yeah.
If I were you, honey, I'd put a ladder up and I'd go through a window if I had to. But you got to stay away from that door for a while. Set up multiple traps. Really empty out that nest and take precautions. You really want to wipe out that nest and you want to try to stay away from that area as much as you can. But I'm telling you, what I would do is I would set up the bug zappers and make a bunch of jar traps.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. You take care now. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll deliver my best mid-season garden advice at noon and 2 p.m. on Sunday, June 26th at a fabulous family event, the Burlington County Earth Fair at historic Smithville Park in Mount Holly, New Jersey. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with great grapes and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. How to grow glorious-looking grapes? The answer is generally not in something you need to spray on the grapes. It's something you need to do to and with the grapes before they get that dreaded look of black rot on them. We'll tell you all about it after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Drew, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Yes, thanks.
Well, thank you, Drew. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. How are you today?
I am doing just ducky, thank you. And where is Drew doing well?
In Mount Gretna, Pennsylvania.
I'm not familiar with that. Where in PA is that?
It's in between Lancaster and Hershey.
Okay. That's a beautiful area out there. What can we do for you, sir?
Well, I was dabbling in growing some blueberries, and I was wondering in terms of the essence of my question is really how much sun, because I've kind of read some conflicting takes on that. So I found a pretty sunny spot in the woods, but I was curious your take and also how it relates to if you think I should throw some bees around there too.
Oh, certainly bees to pollinate your blueberry bushes. Well, as you may have heard during the special interview show we ran a couple of weeks ago, my friend Lee Reich thinks blueberries are the biggest reward for the least work. He considers them in many ways the perfect fruit and his favorite fruit. So there's a couple of things. I don't think there is any discussion about the amount of sun that blueberries need. They want as much sun as possible. They want sun that begins in the morning and that ends at the end of the day. It is a direct equation with blueberries. The more sun you get, the faster the plants will establish in size and the more berries you're going to get. Number two is the more plants you have, the more berries you'll get faster. Blueberries are one of those fruits that whether or not they self-pollinate, it doesn't matter. If there's a lot of plants around, you're going to get a mammoth amount of pollination and fruits. And one thing Lee pointed out, or I remembered re-listening to that old interview with him, is there are three basic seasons of blueberries. There are early, mid-season, and late varieties. So rather than just have a big 3 or 4 week cluster, let's say you're going to put in a dozen plants, you can put in four different varieties of each seasonality, and you can extend the harvest to go for many, many months. And the right conditions are almost pure peat moss. They are plants that occur naturally in nature in peat bogs. So this is an occasion where you want to find really well-draining soil. You don't want to plant them in any kind of clay deposit. You really want to remove as much of the native soil as you can. And you want to go out, and depending on the number of plants you're installing, buy several bales of milled peat moss and mix as much of it in with the soil as you can. And then mulch the surface of the soil with more peat moss. Blueberries require the most acidic soil of anything we grow. And the way to tell is real easy. If you have a little paper cut on your finger and it gets in the soil without you having a glove on, if the soil is good for the blueberries, it should make your finger hurt.
Okay.
That's how acid the soil should be. And then the only other thing that you have to realize after that is that birds are going to fight you for every berry. So the smart money says, as you're planting your blueberry patch, to drive a couple of stakes in the ground, get a big roll of netting, and establish a system where you can go through a screen door in a tent, a flexible screen door. You know, they even make those things to go in and out of your house without opening your sliding door, where you can open up a zipper and go inside this giant screened area and pick. The most successful blueberry patches I've seen are inside essentially soft cages. And the nice thing about it being a soft tent screening material is at the end of the season, after the berries are done, you can just whip it off and put it in the cellar and store it for the following season. And then you can enjoy the full sight of those blueberries in the fall, which turn the most insane fall colors. They're one of the most colorful leaf changers in the fall.
Oh, great. Okay.
So they're really magnificent plants.
All right. Well, I appreciate the advice. And, I'll get cracking. I'm going to plant a few more. So.
All right. Good luck, Drew.
Okay. Thank you again.
Take care, sir. Bye-bye.
Take care. You too.
Bye. 1-888-346-9499. Marie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thank you for taking my call.
Hello, Marie. Thank you for making it. Where are you?
I'm in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Okay. And what can we do for Marie in Pittsburgh?
Well, my husband and I just moved into a house in March, and we have followed all your advice. We put raised beds in because we live in the city.
Good.
We are signed up to get our soil tested. We signed up for a composting class. And I thought we were off to this excellent start. And then I noticed there's a peach tree in the corner of the yard. And
that nobody told you about before.
No. No. I thought, no, they couldn't have planted a peach. Mike always says how hard it is to plant.
That doesn't stop people from putting them in. Yeah.
It's a small peach tree.
Good.
It's maybe 6 to 7 feet tall.
Probably a true dwarf variety.
Okay, and there's only one. There's not been any flowers that we've seen so far. It doesn't have another one to cross-pollinate with.
Well, that wouldn't stop the flowers.
Okay.
Flowers, a single tree with no other tree around for 100 miles in any direction will still produce flowers under the right conditions.
Okay.
But you need other flowers around and then bees or other pollinators to turn those flowers into fruits.
We asked the original owner because they were in to visit relatives in the area. And they
right.
said, no, it's the peach. But they didn't say like the cultivar or like you said, if it's dwarf or not. And there's like suckers coming out at the bottom. And
okay. And you didn't ask them how old the thing was or anything.
We didn't get a chance to. No,
okay.
It was like a real quick conversation.
And you saw no flowers whatsoever?
No flowers this spring.
Okay.
Not at all.
Well, I've never seen a peach tree send up suckers. So, but they did say that it was a peach tree.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And the leaves look, because I've picked peaches, these are definitely
okay.
peach leaves.
Okay. Well, the first thing you want to do is get rid of those suckers coming up around the base of the tree. And the best
okay.
and the best way to get those, believe it or not, is to snap them off. Lee Reich once told me there's some hormonal thing going on, that if you prune them with a pair of cutters, they keep coming back. But if you snap them off, they stay gone.
Okay.
But they're not a good sign. Does the tree get good sun?
There's a shed, and then 3 feet to the right of that is a tree, and then about 3 feet to the back of that is the fence that's the yard divider.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has a shadow from those items until the sun gets high enough. So it's probably sunny there from maybe 1 p.m. to about 5 or 6.
Okay.
So it's like a partial sun.
I'm going to suggest that it's not flowering because it's not getting enough sun.
Okay.
What I would suggest this season is keep snapping off any suckers that come up at the base. Between now and, let's say, the 4th of July, you can prune off a couple of big branches. But ideally, what I would suggest is in the very late winter, like around
okay.
February, that you have the new hole dug already.
Okay.
You would do that. Yeah, you ever try to dig soil in February, honey? That's why the grave diggers look at you funny if you die in the winter. You dig the hole before Thanksgiving. You cover it with a piece of plywood so nobody falls in. You remember where it is. And then in like February, you go out and you can remove one half to one third of the tree, the big branches, both to prune it for its first time and also to make it easier to move. And then
okay.
really soak the soil well, rock that thing out of the ground, take your time, really try to get it out with as many roots intact as possible, move it into the new hole, plant it nice and high in the ground, not low in the ground, replace it with the native soil, keep it watered if the weather is dry, even in the winter, and there's a good possibility it would even flower for you that season.
Oh, that would be nice.
But it sounds like it's not getting enough sun to flower.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I enjoy the show. Hopefully you'll be carried in Pittsburgh soon. That would be great.
I'm surprised that we haven't been. We got picked up by State College, so we're in the middle of the state. Pittsburgh is such a hip place. They have such a great gardening community. So, yeah, well, call your local public radio station and tell them to put it on.
We'll do. I'm a member, so I will call. I will let them know.
We love members. Thank you for that phone call.
You're welcome.
All right, bye. Marie. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Grapes. Proper pruning and thinning can prevent black rot. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden. Get us started with this week's question, please.
Sure, Mike. Angelo in Springfield, Delaware County, PA writes, "Every year I get a nice initial production of grapes from my backyard vines, but they eventually develop blackish spots, dry up, and die. My father says it's, quote, black rot. Is there anything I can do to prevent it?"
I'll tell you what. Let's begin the answer with a similar question.
Okay. Ying, who is, quote, doing well in Clinton, New Jersey, writes, "Every year in the late spring, I get beautiful little green grapes, but by midsummer, they're all dry and dark looking. I've tried all kinds of fungicide sprays, but none helped. I showed the grapes to my local extension office, but they had no idea what it was. I think you're stalling because you don't actually grow grapes."
Ha! Good guess. But if this were subject avoidance, I just would have picked a different topic. No, I wanted to include Ying's email because of the back and forth we later had, which is shockingly typical of people with grapevine problems.
Let's see. You asked if they got good sun and airflow, and Ying said yes. Do you prune the vines every winter? Ying said, yes, but can you explain exactly how to prune them? And finally, you asked, do you remove grape leaves and fruit clusters during the growing season? And Ying answered, no, I don't even know what that means.
Which makes me very disappointed with the response he got from his extension office. As with tree fruits, proper care of grapevines often prevents these kind of disease problems. But none of that care is intuitive. You really have to learn what to do and then do it faithfully every year.
Like removing grape leaves and baby fruit clusters. Isn't that similar to what you have to do with your peaches?
It's very similar. The problem with both plants is their natural lushness. Left on their own, they'd quickly get overcrowded and block airflow to the fruits.
And it sounds like both plants also produce too many fruits.
Exactly. Way too many. So let's take this step by step. First, grapevines are full sun plants. They'll never do well in any kind of shade. Or in soil that doesn't drain well. They also can't be crowded by other plants or overfed. A nice mulch of compost underneath is all they need.
And what about those specific rules for pruning?
Well, all grapevines need to be pruned pretty dramatically in the late winter. But the exact style of that pruning depends on what varieties you're growing and what kind of trellising system you're using. Grapes are vines that require strong support, and the exact method of winter pruning will have a lot to do with the style of trellising you have in place. Your local extension office should have bulletins on proper pruning and trellising for your area, but I'd use those just as a supplement to the excellent advice in Lee Reich's books. He's my guide for organic fruit growing.
Okay, so let's say your grapevines are out in the open in full sun, pruned according to your specific variety and your type of trellis. Now what?
Well, now comes the part where a lot of people fall down. In his most recent book, Grow Fruit Naturally, our old friend Lee Reich notes that grape arbors are notorious for becoming tangled messes of low-quality, disease-ridden grapes. Preventing this from happening, he explains, is all about light and air. If you prune properly and have an excellent trellising system, fruit thinning during the season might not even be necessary. But it takes many years to develop true pruning courage. And sometimes the vines still get too lush. So if you can see that it's crowded, you need to remove both grape leaves and whole clusters of developing baby fruits.
Is there some kind of guide as to when and how much to remove?
Yeah, it's called personal honesty. You really need to be able to look at the vines in June and July with the perspective of, I probably need to remove some leaves and fruit clusters to get more air and light in there. You'll always get a good harvest with that kind of an attitude. Be in denial and you'll get black rot, especially if it turns out to be a wet and cloudy season.
Oh, and Ying ended with, I remember Mike mentioning a product called Surround in one of his shows. Do you think that it's applicable here?
Surround is the brand name for a micronized clay spray. It forms a thin film on fruits that protects them against many diseases and insect pests. It sure seems to work great, and it's the only thing I spray on my peaches. It should work equally well on grapes. But if I personally had grapes I wanted to spray to prevent disease, I would first turn to a fungicide whose active ingredient is a really interesting naturally occurring organism known as Bacillus subtilis. It's very effective at disease prevention. It's specifically EPA registered for use against black rot, and it's approved for use in certified organic agriculture. It's sold under brand names like Plant Guardian and Serenade. Just remember that no spray can ever replace proper plant placement, pruning, and thinning. Well, that sure was a nice introduction to the obligation of growers what want good grapes now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to thin my clusters if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. As long as you remember to include your location, that's where you live in garden.
Please, 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 oh, we need that information.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's webpage wonders. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is Al Banks. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our hired hand is Matt Hudecki. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'm going to get myself a light pruning so that I'm nice and bright and airy when I see you again next week. Are there still cinders in cinder blocks? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll investigate whether those big blocks are safe to use around people and plants, plus your fabulous phone calls.